Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our special program this morning is on Jews of Color, with our guests Nate Looney and Jenna Green. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Today is the Great American Commemoration, the 4th of July, a day of fireworks, baseball, barbecues, and the celebration of United States freedom. This will be a very special 4th, our first since last year's pandemic-restricted non-celebration. It's great to be able to fully embrace a day of outdoor festivities in vaccinated safety. No masks are required for most of us anymore, no more seemingly permanent social distancing from those we love and care about. It's a chance to catch up and spend time with family and friends, to celebrate our nation with fireworks and parades as it was intended. I hope everybody enjoys a really great 4th this year in a healthier, much more open, and God willing, happier nation than we were a year ago today. A word about freedom, especially as it pertains to Jews on this 4th of July. As Jews, we've been uniquely blessed to experience true religious freedom in the United States. And while we have contributed greatly to this country, we have received greatly as well. To play us in on this summer morning on Two Jewish on the theme of Independence Day, here's Mandy Patinkin's Yiddish version of the Irving Berlin classic, God Bless America. Only this time it's Gott Bench America, blended with that most American of all songs and sports, also written by a Jewish guy, Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Nimm mich mit zu der Ballgame, zu Eulam, lo mir doch gehen. Kauf mir den Nislach und Cracker Jack, will ich kein Mul von dort nicht weg. Jetzt seh gut, mut mut die Ballspieler, es passt nicht, als man verspielt. Weil sie sehen, zwei, drei Steigs neus bei der Baseballspiel.
Bench America, Land, wo sich lieb, steh je bei ihr, Madrich sei ihr, überall echt das Strahl und Schlieb. Von die Berge zu den Prairies, bis die Armin weiß mit Schau.
Okay, so now we are fully enjoying the 4th of July, thanks to Mandy Patinkin. This is a good weekend to reflect on the idea of Jewish identity in America. While for so many generations we struggled with just how complete our acceptance was in American society, nowadays Jews have run for president, even won primaries, and vice president on major party tickets, been cabinet officers and Supreme Court justices, become a big part of the Senate and the House, had all kinds of films made about us, been accepted to country clubs and social organizations, owned and played on World Series, Super Bowl, and NBA and NHL championship teams, and been widely accepted within American society to a degree that implied, at least, well, for a while, full acceptance by almost all of America. In general, things had become so welcoming for Jews in America that right here on Too Jewish, I once said anti-Semitism had nearly ceased to be a significant problem for American Jews. Unlike Europe, where anti-Semitism always seems to live in the very soil of the continent, America had appeared to be headed away from any real recurrence of the ancient evil of anti-Semitism that has plagued our planet and especially our people for over 2,000 years. For a while, it seemed as though anti-Semitism was no longer acceptable in civilized America. And then, over the past few years, something disturbing took place right here. There was a most unwelcome comeback of vicious, old-fashioned anti-Semitism, expressed not only in hostile words and symbolic acts, but in violence that had, quite literally, never been seen before in the United States, came to a climax in the murderous attacks on the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh about 20 months ago, followed by the attack on the synagogue in Poway, San Diego, 16 months ago, and then attacks on a kosher market in New Jersey and a Hanukkah party in New York. And then, after the relative calm imposed by the pandemic, we experienced a rash of anti-Semitic acts in recent months. Open violence in public places in Los Angeles, New York, and elsewhere, including right here in Tucson. These attacks came not just from the old-line bigots and Jew-haters of the right, the kind who marched with tiki torches and shouted, "Jews will not replace us," but also from progressive anti-Zionists on the left who dressed up their anti-Semitic slogans and actions in the U.S., including physical attacks, as somehow justified because they hate Israel and don't think Jews have a right to a country. In the space of just a few years, a level of nastiness and of anti-Semitic violence against Jews has again rattled the American Jewish community. So after this sad and unfortunate trend, on this 4th of July 2021, where do we Jews actually stand in this land of the free, in the first real nation on earth where we have, generally speaking, constantly enjoyed full and enduring religious freedom? It all reminds me of a Paul Simon song from my teens, his lovely and slightly sad American tune, Paul Simon, of course, Jewish. It's about all the American immigrants' embrace of liberty and the disappointments and pragmatism of making it through each day. To highlight the bluesy quality of Simon's original song, Mandy Patinkin, again, recorded it in Yiddish on his Mama Lushan album, and I think it's a perfect play-in for this Too Jewish show in honor of the 4th of July, another one. To be American, to be Jewish, to be hopeful, and a little sad about how things are going at the moment. Kind of perfect, really.
Verschricht sich aber es so lustig, freudig sein, als euren Goll ist Goll. Als euren Goll ist Goll. Seinen meine Bekannte alle zermisst. Ich hab kein Fein, was geht im Weiß mir auch allem, was ist nicht und siehst, von Päumlech geworden heuer, nur gute Sechs, guter Säu, a Säu lang heigle. Nur ich will von unser Begon a kleinem Freund, Wo seinen mir verfolgen, sei Meucha, wo seinen mir verfolgen.
per malcha mori. Nehmt meine Schumme, putze moi haroi, sie guckt da rock in die Leu, schmeche barrie koi, und ich flieh wie am Mala. Und unten sehen bei Deugen sie neuf, die Statue of Liberty, wo sie gold weit von hier. Und ich flieh wie ein Maler.
Mandy Patinkin singing Paul Simon's American Tune. The paradoxical nature of American identity that that song highlights is very appropriate for Jews, considering when Paul Simon wrote that song, the President of the United States, Richard Nixon, felt free to be brutally anti-Semitic in his private comments, while publicly having the very Jewish Henry Kissinger run his foreign policy. And Nixon and Kissinger basically saved Israel during the Yom Kippur War that year by arranging an emergency airlift of supplies and ammunition. Well, thank God, Israel is far more secure now than it was then, and we can hope that the troubling flow of anti-Semitism of recent days will also recede. When we return on Too Jewish in just a moment, we have a special program on Jews of Color, the challenges and reality today. Our guests will be Nate Looney, Manager of Racial Justice Initiatives at Avodah, and Gina Green, Partner and Chief Strategy Officer at Uprise. Meet them both when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the whole metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone once again. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. You can also join us Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We will continue to hold all of our services live, but also with full music by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, or go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org, beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended formats as well, students both live and on Zoom, and we're registering right now for August. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course, all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, beitsimchatucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing, newest, and, well, best Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting and enjoyable beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish a very special program. We're talking to, I guess the official title of this is Jews of Color. We're meeting with Gina Green and Nate Looney. Nate is the manager of racial justice initiatives at Avodah. And Gina is a strategist, writer, movement builder, consultant, and partner, and chief strategy officer at Uprise, which works with the progressive movement and the Jewish community. Good morning and welcome both of you to Two Jewish.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Nate, tell us a little bit about Avodah, just kind of on the side, and then we'll move on to more specific stuff.
So Avodah is a Jewish social justice organization that is geared towards building up young leaders. So we focus on our service core, which is young Jews between the ages of 21 to 26. They live in a communal living house with other service corps members, and then they work full-time at a local nonprofit. And built into it is curriculum around looking at social justice from a Jewish lens.
Great work. And Gina, tell us a little bit about your organization and your work.
Thanks, Rabbi. I am the Chief Strategy Officer and partner at Uprise. And at Uprise, we work with the progressive movement and with the Jewish community to basically tell the best stories that we can and move progress forward in the ways that we can do. My work in the Jewish community is very deep, and I've been doing it for quite some time. I have a lot of work with organizations like Avodah and also working with the Jews of Color Initiative, the Jewish Social Justice Roundtable, and others. So I get to, in many ways, have my fingers in a lot of pots.
I want you guys to tell me, and I guess we'll take turns here. Nate, I've worked with Jews of kind of every color, I think. I've always had a very positive experience and open experience in the congregations I've served. That is not always your experience. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing because from one community to the next, the experience can be very different. The ways in which microaggressions show up in our Jewish community it's far-reaching. You know, one of the things that is a common thing that we encounter is being asked, how are you Jewish? Or having to explain why we are in the space that we're in this space. You know, it doesn't matter if I'm in shul, davening, you know, you can hear that I'm speaking Hebrew. When we get time to Kiddush, it never fails. Somebody will come up to me and ask me, are you Jewish? How are you Jewish? You know? And so, you know, that leaves you in a place where you're having to really question, do I belong in this community? Or does this community see me as a part of this community or a perpetual outsider?
You know, I remember interviewing Mara Gad about a year ago on Two Jewish, who'd written successful books, kind of a high-powered gal, grew up Jewish. You know, it wasn't that she was a Jew by choice, not that that should make any difference at all. And she talked about being a presenter at the URJ Biennial, which is, you know, a reform organization committed to social justice, and people treating her as though she were asking her if she was a maid, if she was, you know, could she go take their laundry? I mean, crazy stuff. It sounds crazy to me. It doesn't sound crazy to you guys.
It absolutely isn't crazy. It happens more often than we would like to think or imagine. And, you know, Nate talked about individual experiences, you know, at this shul or that shul or that JCC. And there's also institutional challenges, right? If we don't feel comfortable walking into the door of a building of a community center or a building of a shul, then how do these institutions become places where we can actually serve and lead and engage? It's, you know, it's really hard to think about being a member of the community and being a member of the community when at every turn we can get pushed to the margins. and pushed to the side. And so there's like an individual experience, you know, that Nate was talking about, and then there's a community experience. And what does it mean for the Jewish community and for our Jewish institutions when we aren't the places that we think we are? And, you know, I think that for the Jewish community, because in the United States, so many of us are progressive, so many of us are committed to social justice, so many of us do believe that we should be treated equitably no matter what our skin color or no matter where we came from. But in some ways, because we think that, it's almost as if it's harder for us to believe that we might have a problem.
We will talk much more with Gina Green and Nate Lewin, both about the problem of how the larger Jewish community in America addresses Jews of color, and hopefully some of the solutions when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, twojewishradio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads of Too Jewish on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, last week we started talking about Naples in the south of what is today Italy, but of course it was a separate kingdom for a long time, and we just began to talk about the Jewish community with the Italian branch of the Rothschilds being established in Naples, not in Rome, not in Milan, but in Naples, because that was then the commercial capital. This is probably the early 1800s, I would say, before Italy unified?
It was shortly before unification, so closer to the middle of the 1800s. But yeah, right, 19th century.
So I would assume if the Rothschilds set up anywhere, there had to be a significant Jewish community. If there wasn't, they built it. Tell us a little bit about how Jewish life evolved there.
Both are true, but to start there would be to ignore a really interesting history of the Jewish community in Naples. You know, Naples, like Sicily, started history as a Greek settlement and part of Greece, and it was eventually conquered by the Romans, and the whole Roman world had Greek settlements. So, Jewish settlements.
Right.
So I don't know if there were Jews in Naples during the time that it was called Neapolis, when it was a purely Greek city. But there certainly were from the Roman conquest onward, with certain exceptions. Naples, as we said before, was part of the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, which meant that for many centuries it was ruled by Spain. When Spain put into effect the Alhambra Decree, expelling all Muslims and Jews, they applied that also to their territories outside of Spain, including the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. So Jews of Sicily proper, the island of Sicily, were expelled in 1492 and really never came back until the late 20th and early 21st centuries. There were, you know, 500 years at least where there were
almost no Jews, virtually no Jews in Sicily, right?
Naples has sort of a different story because Naples changed hands more often between a particular German dynasty, a French dynasty, a Spanish dynasty, back and forth. Then it became independent, and then it joined the newly formed nation state of Italy. And under all those regimes, there were periodic expulsions of Jews, and then periodically they were welcomed back. So after being expelled in 1492, they were welcomed back early in the 18th century. So they were gone for, let's say, 230 years. But then they came back, and the modern Jewish community of Naples really dates to that invitation to return early in the 18th century. So where did they come back from? There was no Italy at that time, so it's not logical to assume that they came from other parts of Italy. Some, in fact, came from the island of Sicily, where there are still lots of crypto-Jews, just like there are here in the Southwest. Some came from Central Europe. There were Ashkenazim there. And there were Sephardim from other parts of the Ladino-speaking world, the sort of the Spanish diaspora, which extended to Sarajevo, Thessaloniki, Istanbul, whatever, commercial ports. And they, of course, felt right at home in a bustling commercial port like Naples. So they did all the kinds of jobs that Jews did in these other bustling commercial ports. But because they were living in Roman Catholic territory, they never felt that comfortable there. So the city of Naples, for a long time, was the second biggest city in Europe for many centuries. It was only smaller than Istanbul. And it was by far the biggest city in what is today the territory of Italy. But its Jewish population never exceeded a few thousand. Hmm. It didn't reach numbers like, you know, Cordoba, for example, which right. had, you know, 100,000 Jews. It never had big numbers. It had good quality. It had like Rothschilds and art collectors and whatever. And Jews were, by and large, very prosperous, but a very small minority because they never felt that welcome there.
Well, we'll continue with the story of the Jews of Naples next week. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rabbi Shlomo is leading Torah study at his shul, and all of a sudden an angel appears, a malach. The angel says, Reb Shlomo, you're an example to your fellow humans. You are totally unselfish. Your behavior is faultless. Your Jewish learning extensive. Your tzedakah, your charity exemplary. In return for being such a mensch, I'm going to offer you a choice of your reward. You can either have infinite wealth, infinite health, or infinite wisdom. What will it be, Rabbi Shlomo? Whatever you choose will be immediately granted. Without hesitation, Shlomo replies, I would love to have infinite wisdom. Mazel tov, Rabbi Shlomo, says the angel, done. Enjoy. The angel disappears. For a few moments, there is a stunned silence in the Torah study group. Nobody can believe what just happened in front of their eyes. Then one of the people breaks the silence. Reb Shlomo, he asks, why don't you test out your newfound wisdom? Say something really wise to us, Rabbi. And Shlomo answers, I should have taken the money. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well, and next time, take the money. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Matot and Maaseh, the last sections of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. Both teach an important message about the centrality of Jewish family values, but they do so in quite different ways. The setting for these final parshiot in Numbers is the border of the Promised Land, as the Israelites approach Canaan for a second time after their 40-year sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, two of them, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request of Moses. We like the land we're traveling through now, here on the east bank of the Jordan, what is today the country of Jordan, long before the Arab peoples moved into the Middle East. Anyway, the leaders of Reuben and Gad say, let us stay here and build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children. Moses agrees, but in interesting language. First, he tells them, build towns for your children. Only then build sheepfolds for your flocks. The message is clear. Families come first. Our professions and income second. It is a human message, one that we need to relearn in every generation. Put family first. Then, in the very last section of Numbers, called Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created called the City of Refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was accomplished by the family of the victim. Vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by killing. If you killed somebody, intentionally or accidentally, even if the family of a person who was killed just thought you'd committed the crime, you would likely be killed by their kinsmen. Which meant that if you were involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to remain alive, even if the killing was accidental, even if you were innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, it wouldn't help. This kind of reprisal killing also could and did lead to cycles of revenge, the sort of blood feuds that Mark Twain described in the Hatfield and McCoy's sections of his book several millennia later, the kind of clan murder revenge cycles that take place even today in the Palestinian Arab towns of the West Bank and Gaza. To preclude this impending social disaster, the Torah portion of Maaseh provides for six cities of refuge in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters those cities may be executed without a trial, and a fair one. Being present in the city of refuge is a kind of protection, a guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history up to quite recent times. Yet, the Torah established this principle some 3,000 years ago. Whether it did so to protect innocents accused of murder or simply to keep families from falling into cycles of murder and revenge, we don't know. But we do know the Torah teaches us in this very different way that the most basic unit of society must be nurtured, maintained, and protected. The family's positive values strengthened, even in the most trying situations. A great message still. When we come back, we'll continue our program on Jews of Color, discussing with Nate Looney of Avodah and Gina Green of Uprise their own experiences within the Jewish community as Jews of color. Here's some fascinating and disturbing stories that'll open your eyes when we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The foundation stone has been laid for a quote-unquote city of Torah in Mexico, the first village in Latin America to be comprised almost exclusively of Haredi, ultra-Orthodox Jews. The village, under construction near Iztapan de la Sal, a small town about 75 miles southwest of Mexico City, will begin with 40 houses and hopes to attract 120 families by 2024. Its developers said during a ceremony last week that marked the project's launch. It will span about a square mile at first and feature a yeshiva, synagogues, and schools for both its Ashkenazi and Sephardic populations, a kosher supermarket, and a gym complex with a pool, spa, and sport venue. The funding is primarily from a businessman, Abraham Mizrahi, who is not Haredi ultra-Orthodox. Mexican Rabbi Yosef Tawil was appointed chief of the town's rabbinical council. He is Haredi. The project's lead developer, Moises Shemaria, also not Haredi ultra-Orthodox, mentioned the town of Lakewood, New Jersey, a municipality with a high proportion of ultra-Orthodox Jews, in his speech at the groundbreaking event. We are open to receive Haredim from Mexico and Latin America, he said. Our brothers from Argentina, Venezuela, Panama, Chile, and others deserve to live in a first-class place with Torah. They cannot buy a $1 million apartment in Lakewood. They will be welcomed here with nice houses from $120,000. But the town may bear more similarities to the village of Palm Tree, formerly known as Kiryas Yoel, in New York State, or Kiryas Joel, depending on how you say it, an enclave mostly made up of 20,000 Yiddish-speaking Orthodox Jews that seceded from the larger town back in 2017. Shamaria referred several times in his speech to the regional scope of the project, saying the first 40 houses have been sold to buyers from Mexico, Argentina, and Venezuela. He added, house prices will range from $120,000 to $218,000. Get the 18. Mexico is home to about 40,000 Jews, according to Hebrew University demographer Sergio de la Pergola. He estimates that Latin America as a whole has a Jewish population of somewhere between 400,000 and 700,000. The lower number is probably the core Jewish population. Those who strongly identify as Jewish, the higher figure would count everybody with enough Jewish ancestry to have the option of becoming an Israeli citizen. In Argentina, the country with the largest Jewish population, a project similar to Ciudad de la Torah had been planned but was never carried out. In New Haven, Connecticut, Yale Student Council approved a statement authored by a campus pro-Palestinian group accusing Israel of genocide, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid. Lovely. Yale campus Jewish groups condemned the statement as having anti-Semitic overtones. No kidding. The Yale College Council, the undergraduate student government, approved the statement first authored by Yalees for Palestine last week in an 8-3 vote with 4 abstentions. Yalees for Palestine released the statement back on May 12th during the Israel-Gaza war. As Yale students, we condemn the injustice, ethnic cleansing, and genocide occurring in Palestine, it said. The statement also likened Israel's actions during the conflict to police violence against Black Americans. Just as Israel's military imposes the apartheid system against Palestinians, the U.S. police enforces the system of white supremacy against Black Americans, it said. A number of left-leaning campus groups in Yale subsequently endorsed the statement. A group of anti-Zionist Jewish students and alumni released their own statement endorsing the Yalees for Palestine statement. Campus Hillel railed against the resolution, once it was adopted, condemning it as having anti-Semitic overtones. It characterizes the Jewish state as an agent of the world's most reprehensible forces and guilty of the most unspeakable crimes, in other words, demonically. The Hillel response stated, this genealogy may be invisible to its authors and adherents because the outside perfidy they ascribe to the Jewish state is formulated in distinctly contemporary terms, but it is clear, terrifying, and familiar to us. And finally, in happier news, in sports, Boston Bruins defenseman Adam Fox, a Long Island native who grew up a New York Rangers fan, was named the winner of the Norris Trophy last week, signifying the NHL's top defenseman. He is the first Jewish guy to win that award. The 23-year-old, a former star at Harvard, joins Hall of Famer Bobby Orr of the Bruins in winning the NHL award in his second season. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning on this special program, Jews of Color, really in America is what we're talking about. Nate Looney is a manager of racial justice initiatives at Avodah. He is also the CEO and owner of Westside Urban Gardens, an urban agricultural company based in that farming mecca, my native town, Los Angeles, California. And Gina Green is a strategist, writer, movement builder, consultant, partner, and chief strategy officer at Uprise, a consultancy that works with the progressive movement and the Jewish community as a whole. Brief personal anecdote, the first bar mitzvah I did when I was when I came to my congregation here and moved to Tucson was an African-American kid. He's now a Chabad rabbi, by the way. And, you know, I never really thought anything of it except that it was cool. But is thinking it's cool also a kind of microaggression? Like taking pride in the diversity of our Jewish expression?
You know, I'm thinking about that, and part of the challenge is the exotification of Jews of color. I think it's good to have pride in the diversity of our community, but at the same time, not looking at that diversity as being so unique that it's some sort of entertainment.
Right.
Oftentimes in those situations, you know, the person of color has to explain their lineage, you know, how they're Jewish and how they belong in the space. And it can be exhausting if you're experiencing that every single time you enter a new community.
You know, and I don't mean to be flip about it, just it's always occurred to me that the best way to include people is to include them and not to say, isn't it so great that we have this great diverse community? Just be that community. Unfortunately, that's not what you guys mostly experience. Can you give like another example of maybe unconscious racism besides people coming up at Kiddush and saying, oh, are you Jewish?
No, I think this is a great question. You know, I think part... Oh, go ahead, Gina.
I was going to say, thanks, Nate, that it is a great question. And I think what's really tough about it is that we're trying to quantify or capture the totality of experiences that happen to individual people every day. And it might be that that exclusion and that marginalization that happens when we get asked, are we Jewish? How long have we been Jewish? Did we marry someone Jewish? What are these questions? That line of interrogation is significant and is really hard because we don't expect to encounter that type, or we don't want to. I should correct myself. We don't want to encounter that degree of otherness in our faith community. We get it enough out in the world as Black people, as people of color, when it comes to the workplace and when it comes to school and higher education and housing. Like, this happens all the time. So to be excluded, whether it's by programming that doesn't reflect who we are and the diversity of our community, whether it means going to an event and feeling like we are the only ones and haven't been seen or heard, or whether it is asking the very rude questions, which I get, they stem from a curiosity because so many folks in our community haven't met Jews of color their entire lives. I met a Jewish woman in my former office when I, before I became a consultant at a Jewish organization, and she was 60 plus years old. And she said to me that basically, until she met me, she hadn't met a Jew of color. And this was 2 years ago. Hmm. So I understand the curiosity that we may have in the community about people who don't look like what we would expect a Jew to do and be. But I think that, like you said, that inclusion piece, that just being inclusive, is what we should do. And it's a much taller order than we think to actually get to a point of inclusion, to getting beyond diversity and just having, you know, Black folks and Latino folks and Indigenous Jews in the pews, but actually having us at the board, actually having us participating in programming and guiding programming and informing programming and having us be a part of the community and not just folks that we want to ask, how'd you get here, too?
You know, I wonder, there's lots of Jews who are really proud that Drake is Jewish, and he probably doesn't get asked too often if it's okay for him to be at shul that morning. But that's not, I think, it's nice. It's just not terribly helpful. What kinds of steps can we take to, besides being on Too Jewish, to educate people about the inclusion aspect? It's not even inclusion, it's acceptance, and I think full acceptance of people of every color and race who are Jewish, because frankly, if you go to Israel, you don't have any problem. Skin color is not a question. There is bias within the society, but still, it's not like somebody questions whether Ethiopians who have moved to Israel and now have grown up and gone to the IDF are Jewish. Tell us, what do you think we could do here?
I think the first step is educate, self-educating. You know, there's a unnecessary burden that gets put on Jews of color and people of color to educate white identified folks about what diversity is all about. What I would push people to do is to educate themselves. There is a wealth of books, documentaries, podcasts that folks can refer to learn about ways to be actively anti-racist. There also needs to be an intentional effort around educating our Jewish community as organizations. So that looks like educating your congregants about the ways that microaggressions and implicit bias shows up. It's also a step that should be taken is ensuring that there's diversity at all levels of leadership. It's not enough to just make space for people in the congregation or in the organization, but as Gina was saying, at all levels of leadership, from, you know, CEO to board members and everything in between, to make sure that the numbers reflect what we know our JOC community to be, which is clear is around 1 million of our North American Jewish population are people that identify as Jews of color.
Wow. So a million of the, I don't know, 6 or 7 million Jews in North America identify as Jews of color. Wow.
And that number is going to grow, right? Just like
for sure.
The United States itself, the Jewish community is going to become a higher proportion of people of color over the next 50 years. So we are literally, you know, in the middle of major demographic shifts. And I think it's important to recognize that even though we are becoming a browner community, if you will, more people of color over the next several decades, we've always been diverse since the beginning of time, since the beginning of the Jewish community, right? And right. So I think that's really important for us to recognize. The other thing that I'll lift up that Nate didn't say in terms of what we can do is really thinking about what it means for what community means. And I think one of the things I think about is as we are growing, as Jews of color are growing in the United States, there needs to be greater attention to our specific experiences, and our community spaces need to speak to that. Like decades and years of being marginalized and excluded mean that we have developed traditions and we've developed ways of being, and we want to be able to be welcomed in at the same time, honoring that those experiences have been different, and having spaces for Jews of color to do and be Jews of color is really important. I think this means making sure that Jews of color have the ability to create spaces where we can be Jews and people of color. And that means that organizations like Avoda, Nate's organization that's launching the JSB Byte, which is a service course specifically for Jews of color. It means organizations like the Black Jewish Liberation Collective, who sponsored a Jew King Seder last month that was specifically for Black Jews. It means organizations like Ben Liark, who is launching Project Shamash this year, which is a program designed to prepare and equip Jews of color and Jewish institutions to be places where Jews of color can lead and be. These kinds of interventions that are for Jews of color and led by Jews of color are important because it helps Jews of color actually become better members of the fuller Jewish community too. We all win when we can create spaces where we can be who we are.
So I'm going to ask one last question, and maybe a difficult one. Are there differences between the denominations or the streams of Judaism in terms of how Jews of color are treated?
Ooh, that is a good
one. That's good.
Nate, yeah.
Maybe a little dangerous question, but, you know.
You know, Nate and I both, I say that I run in modern Orthodox circles. And for me, my personal experience has been one that I would say has been more challenging in certain mono-Orthodox environments. And I think that is because in those environments, I think there's a religious denominational split in that, yes, there are Black and people of color Orthodox Jews, but there is a smaller proportion of us in that denomination than in, for example, Reform and Conservative movements. So I think that there is a denominationally less exposure to Black Jews and Jewish people of color within the Orthodox movement. And so to Nate's point about education and visibility, those being two major factors, I think make it harder in those communities for acceptance and reception. But to be clear, everything is not always, you know,
hearts and flowers. Yeah.
Reform and conservative spaces.
No, no. I think that that's been an eye-opening experience for me in the last year, just because, I don't know, I remember we always have kids in my old congregation. We always had kids preparing for bar mitzvah. We do it in my congregation now. Come up on the bima and do help lead the service, you know, on a Shabbat morning, on a Friday night. So there was always kids up there who were 12 years old. And I remember one group, there was a boy, there was a Vietnamese girl who had been adopted. There was a Korean girl who was her sister who'd been adopted. They were both coming up for bat mitzvah. We had an African-American guy. We had a Japanese, half-Japanese young woman. And I thought, like, that's Judaism in the 2000 teens at the time, right? That's what it really is in America now. It's going to be like that. And I thought it was great. And the congregants thought it was great too, and I sort of felt like everybody must feel that way. And the answer is not so much. We need to do a lot of work. I want to thank you both, Gina Green and Nate Lewin, for a terrific visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about what they can do and both of your work?
So as far as Avodah goes, the JOC Bayit, we're launching our first cohort in August. You can go to avodah.net and look at our service corps and find out information there. If you know of folks that would be a great fit for the program, go ahead and nominate them through our website. And in addition, if you're looking about finding out more information about what you can do as far as being actively anti-racist in the Jewish community, we created a racial justice guide that's open for anyone to download and use, and that's also found on our website.
Thank you both. Really appreciate it, and keep up the good work, as we say. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rabbi Josh Weinberg, Vice President of the Union for Reform Judaism for Israel and Reform Zionism, and Executive Director of Arts of the Association of Reform Zionists of America. Our playout this morning comes from the very silly songs of Doug Cutler. For Independence Day today, the 4th of July, it's his Jewish USA. Don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services and Oneg Shabbat, starting at 6:30 p.m. with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. for Torah study, 10 a.m. for services and Torah reading. Please join us or come on Facebook or Zoom. My friends, have a great 4th of July and a safe one. A Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of health and of peace.
Torah across the USA, then everybody be Jewish like you and me today. You'd see them wearing a tallit in shul on Saturday if everybody was Jewish.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.